thatgreatbusinessshow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to episode 71 of That Great Business Show, posting on the 21st of January, 2022. I'm Conal O'Moran. On this episode of what our listeners call Ireland's best business podcast, we have a business run by one of Beyoncé's besties. Yes, that Beyoncé. We have a 12-year-old winner of Entrepreneur of the Year, and we have a new occasional slot where we're giving your business some free business law advice. This week, we're looking at some truly curious legal facts around whistleblowing in business. And as always, we do business differently. Another bit of advice this week is that sharing is caring. We get literally thousands of views and likes for our social media postings for the podcast. I think Harry Goddard, that's the CEO of Deloitte, who joined us on episode 68, has racked up over 10,000 views so far. And that's good, really good. But what we want, need our shares. Sharing is just as simple as liking, but it means that you help get a link to this podcast straight to our social media connections. That means you're helping us by helping them, and they love you for it. As we say, sharing is caring. And all of this love, liking, and sharing is made possible by That Great Business Show sponsor, De Facto Shaving Solution. You can help them grow their business by buying their product, the world's best shaving oil, made in Mayo, sold worldwide. Get it at defactoshave.com.
Backing great women-led businesses on every show. That Great Business Show.
I told my first guest today that I would be introducing her as one of Beyoncé's besties and not as co-founder of Boundless HQ, an Ireland-based company that helps companies grow teams internationally, allowing employers to hire whoever they want, wherever they are. Boundless is a platform that helps small and medium-sized businesses manage employees no matter where in the world they're based. And the company is backed by Brian Caulfield, one of this country's savviest investors. Brian joined us on episode 67 of the podcast, and he said then that we should talk to them. So we did. Dee Coakley, Beyoncé's bestie and co-founder of Boundless HQ. Welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thank you so much. I would love to know if Beyoncé would describe me in such warm terms.
We, you and I, and most others, we hang on to, oh, I met him once, and it could have been in the Jacks or something. But the question that all business owners want to know, what is she really like?
She is actually a very lovely person. I'd be fairly confident in saying I doubt she remembers me. I doubt I left a huge mark on her life. But yeah, I did work with her briefly, worked more closely with her father, who was her manager at that time. He's a more difficult character to deal with, shall we say.
Mr. Knowles. I was reading about
Mr.
him.
Mr. Knowles,
he's
yes,
a lawyer.
Matthew, yeah. Previously worked with Xerox, was in Xerox for many years and became her manager when she was a very young child.
And go on, tell us, how did you end up, because we'll get on to Boundless in a second, how did you get on working with Beyoncé?
So I worked in the music industry for many years. Sometimes when I say that to people, they say, oh, you're a performer. Very far from that. I don't think anyone would pay me any money to sing or perform any music. I worked in record companies and in artist management for years. So I joined a company called the Sanctuary Group in London. It is no more. It was absorbed into Universal Music. But I joined them and worked in the artist management division for a while, specifically in the tour production department. So we used to produce Beyoncé's tours, which was really exciting. It was a lot of fun.
Who do you answer to there? Is it the manager, or does she come in and say, listen, I want to do this, or I need that, or the famous, you know, I need no blue M&Ms and all that kind of stuff?
So definitely the management. When you're working in tour production, you're dealing with the manager more than the artist. But all artists, even smaller artists, will have a tour manager. And a guy called Alan Floyd, her cousin, well, I believe he's still her tour manager, I think. He was her tour manager then. And he also is a very nice person and a good friend of mine who used to sit beside me in that job. He went on to set up his own tour travel company, and he still does all of her travel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of which there hopefully will be in the future a lot of.
Fingers crossed.
And I was waiting to say this, but you gave it all up for rock and roll.
I did. So I do remember when I worked in music for 7 years, but it was throughout my 20s. So it's a pivotal point in your life. And I think at that age, 7 years
feels
like a long time.
You don't have to say when you was in your 20s. You just say a while ago.
A couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember people that were further along in their careers than me at that time, in people in the music industry saying to me, oh, it's a young person's game. You know, you probably won't do this forever. And it's a very common thing, actually, in that industry that people leave the year they turn 30. It's a bit of a cliche.
Okay.
I think it's at the age when people start applying for mortgages or having babies or, you know, whatever it is. And I was the cliche the year I turned 30. I thought I'm not really getting what I want from my career in this sector. Well, and I made the move.
2 episodes ago, we had Pat Egan, the promoter, on. That was episode 69, it must be. He's 75 and he's still promoting and can't get enough of it.
Anyone that makes it that far, they're made of strong stuff. It's a tough, tough industry. It's a lot of fun. I mean, I made the most of it. You know, I was often going to 2 or 3 gigs a night. I was out almost every night of the week with colleagues. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, I grew out of it, I think.
But skipping lightly along, Boundless. What does Boundless do? Why Boundless? What is it? Where did you come up with the idea? All the above.
So if I give you a high level overview of my couple of years before Boundless, it will help you to understand where the idea came from and also why it is that anyone would want to use Boundless. So after I left music, I joined the tech sector. I felt like this internet thing was going to be big. It seemed like there would be a few opportunities there. I actually thought I would get experience in tech and then start a music tech startup or go back to music with that experience. But honestly, I would say in my first week working with a software company, I thought I will never go back. I love the music industry. I really enjoyed it. I had a huge passion for it. But as soon as I started in software, it was intoxicating.
I'm home.
Yeah, just working with incredibly smart people building the future. And I realized almost instantly that was where I wanted to be. So I spent 10 years in COO roles with B2B software companies. So I always had responsibility for finance, legal and HR, and experienced some of the challenges that Boundless now solves. But my last COO role was with an Irish company you may know of, Axonista.
I do.
With a great CEO called Claire McHugh. And I worked with Axonista. It's an interactive video tech company. And we were hiring people to be co-located in Dublin out of our head office. But we did, over time, we had a couple of people that moved to work remotely in Ireland and people would travel for work. We were set up to support remote work.
This is long before COVID.
Yeah, this is a few years before COVID. And we found that lots of members of the team were not from Ireland. And over time, once people were a couple of years in, they'd want to move back to their home country. So we used to get these requests, people saying, I'm coming to hand in my notice because I'm sick of the Irish weather, or, you know, I want to
sick
be
of the Irish.
No, we didn't get that so much, but we definitely got the weather one a few times. Or people wanted to be near family or they were starting families of their own. And these people had really specialist skills. They were data scientists or video engineers. We weren't going to be able to turn around and find another one within a few days. So we would say, you know, you can keep your job. We really value you. We value your skills. You've built our product. Keep your job. And then it will be mentioned in passing to me as the COO and I'd have to figure out how to make that happen.
Okay.
And that's really difficult. So if you're an Irish company and a member of your team moves to France, suddenly you have to comply with French employment law. And, French employment law particularly, it's a pretty challenging one. If you're a US company and you're employing someone anywhere in Europe, it's terrifying because, you know, if you have people in New York, they're not getting the kind of rights that Europeans are getting.
We have things called health and safety and all those kinds of things.
All kinds of inconveniences. So So yeah, suddenly you're complying with French employment law. You also have to process payroll in a way that's compliant with the system there. You have to make sure you're paying in tax through the French system, paying the person through the French system. And there's a lot of ongoing maintenance and upkeep with that. You know, we're fairly structured with our laws here. We tend to give plenty of notice to employers. Not all countries operate that way. Laws can be brought in at a moment's notice and you need to be on top of those changes. So with great difficulty, I set up employment and payroll for 7 countries during my time at Axonista. And when I say great difficulty, it was unbelievably difficult and painful. So it took us about 8 months for Spain, 9 months for France. It was slow. There was a lot of form filling. You were couriering wet ink signatures to offices in Germany and France, and you'd be contacting people for months trying to see where on earth your documents were. Months into the process, you'd just be told your file was missing. You had to start at the start again. So I had a really good COO network in London. I've been based in London for many years. And I started talking to other COOs saying, there has to be an easier way of doing this. I'm obviously not doing it right. And I'd try a slightly different method for each country. I'd say, well, the last country was a disaster. So I'm going to use an intermediary this time. And no matter what way I did it or what service provider I used, it always seemed worse than the last time. And when I spoke to all of these COOs, the vast majority of them were saying, I've been experiencing the same thing. And 100% of them that had tried this and had experienced it said that every way they tried sucked. And it didn't matter how much budget they had, there was no good solution. That got the cogs turning. But I was a very reluctant founder. I was slow to get out of the gates. I did it, but I was reluctant.
What was that like, the jump?
I was under no illusions. I was deeply embedded in the startup sector at this stage. I've been involved in tech for 10 years. This was 3 years ago. You know, to be involved in tech startups for 13 years, I'm a veteran. You know, the tech startup space is still relatively young, certainly in Europe. And I had a lot of friends that ran tech startups. I was very involved in lots of accelerators and mentoring on different programs and things like that. I knew the heartache. I had seen people be destroyed emotionally by trying to build startups. And I knew that it can cause a lot of pain. It's never, ever, ever easy. And chances are you're not going to succeed. The vast majority of startups fail. So I was coming loaded down, weighed down by the weight of reality.
But it didn't stop you.
It didn't stop me.
That's a madness, you know that.
Yeah, it is. It was an inevitability. I mean, now I deeply regret I didn't do it earlier.
Ah, for a second I said, you were going to say, I now deeply regret it. I get my headline.
No, I haven't come on the podcast to announce to announce that I'm giving it all up, I'm happy to say. It was an inevitability. There was kind of nowhere else for me to go. I'd been a COO for 10 years and I had reached a point where I was desperate to try something new. I probably was bored at that point. And the next step needed to be a CEO role because I understood the realities of running startups. I certainly didn't want to inherit someone else's CEO role and be CEO of someone else's dream. That wasn't something that I wanted.
Or their problems.
And inheriting all of their problems, because I knew enough to know that when the CEO baton is being passed over, I think there are probably a lot of challenges. So
Boundless
it needed to be my own thing.
Born.
Boundless was born, yeah. The idea was gnawing away at me. I always had notebooks with ideas, and every now and again I'd take a weekend, often a bank holiday weekend. I'd say, I'm going to go deep on this one. Nothing survived a bank holiday weekend. By day three, I'm quite a cynical person. And by day three, I'd be like, no, so many holes in this one. This is never going to work. And I probably am the type of personality where I will look for, and that's not a classic entrepreneur thing, I will look for the problems and see why something won't work.
I think Brian Caulfield was saying quite the opposite, is that a good entrepreneur looks for the upside, not the downside.
And I think that you'll find a lot of entrepreneurs are, this is maybe a loaded term, blind optimists, I would say. I'd say I'm more of a realist. But when I looked at this one, the problem was huge, and that's what held me back. I thought, I don't know if you could build a decent solution for this problem. It's just so challenging. But the opportunity was so huge, and there was no good solution. And I also knew that the economics of it looked really promising. People would really pay to solve this problem. And I knew that you could link your pricing and invoicing to payroll. And payroll is cyclical, and it is very sticky. A company doesn't pause payroll for a few months. You don't pause your subscription to payroll. So the more and more and more I looked at it, I couldn't deny that there was this great opportunity. So I had to make that leap and give it a go.
And that was 3 years ago, you say?
Yes.
What was day one like?
So it was New Year. It was November 20... I'm so confused. We're all confused about the passage of time now. Yeah. November 2018 was when I started talking to people about this idea. And I remember going to a couple of conferences that November and having... You know when the cogs turn and things fall into place? I remember having a few conversations with people and hearing a few people speaking on stages, and I was connecting dots and going, that's very related to that problem I've had that I've been talking to the people about. And I started to really think about the future of work and where the world was headed, because in tech, and particularly in software product development and in SaaS, remote work was becoming more than very common.
And again, this is pre-COVID.
Well, pre-COVID. Yeah. And this was it, more than a year before COVID.
And then, lucky for you, COVID comes along and gives you the mega boost.
Clearly we could never have predicted it. You know, we had done market sizing and evaluated where we felt the market was headed. But we knew that really it was going to be... tastemakers, people who were risk takers, very forward looking, who were very future focused, they were going to be the leaders that would be open to international remote work, which meant your market was probably going to be software companies. And we sketched out, you know, and considered, when will the rest of the world catch up and what kind of workers? And, you know, as an example, we said, well, civil servants will never be remote workers. You know
how wrong we, you were. Yep,
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, we said people in regulated spaces, so people that work for banks,
people that work for civil service,
we just discounted them and said, well, they're not our market. But we thought, well, the rest of the world, people who are knowledge workers, designers, people in creative roles, software engineers, anyone in technology, conceivably those roles could be done remotely. And we thought that over a period of 8 to 10 years, the world might catch up. And then COVID hit.
8 months later.
Yeah, and we did at the time, we reevaluated. So COVID started in the March, and that July, August, I went back and drew up our market size numbers once again. And COVID, according to our numbers, you know, we felt COVID accelerated things by 10 years.
Well, that is some jump.
Yeah.
So where are you now? You better shout out your co-founder because...
Absolutely. I'm very fortunate to have a great co-founder, Emily Castles. So myself and Emily worked together before at a company I'm sure you'll know of, Bezimply.
I remember Bezimply. Yeah. I remember the name.
Yeah. So Bezimply is an Irish workforce management software company. She and I had worked there together, and she was the first international remote worker that I had ever managed. And I remember her coming to us and saying... I have a proposition for ye. This is not up for discussion. It's not up for debate. I'm doing this. It's a deal breaker. If you can't support me in this endeavor, I'll be handing in my notice.
Okay.
And she was going to Chamonix in France for a ski season. But she promised us faithfully it was one ski season and she'd be back very quickly. I think that was about 7 years ago. She's still there.
Good for her.
Still skiing a few mornings a week.
Now, one of the things, I'm going to pop into France for a second because one of the things I was reading is... The benefits, big area for you, is in various countries. But the French, I never knew this until I was reading about you. The French not want, they demand their lunch money.
They do. And they're not the only ones. There are some other European countries where lunch money is also common.
What does that mean, their lunch money? Somebody has to pay 5 quid or 10 quid a day?
So they're entitled to meal vouchers. There are a few countries like this. We are getting more and more involved in the benefits space. We already support benefits. Maybe I should say at a very high level in case people aren't aware of what we do. We act as a legal employer on our customers' behalf in the countries where we can support employment. We're now live for 20 countries, but we're adding a couple of countries every month.
That's fantastic.
And that means that from our customers' perspective, they can find workers in those countries, get them set up under an employment agreement the same day or, you know, very, very quickly. And we take care of all of the admin headaches and we hold their hand to help them to understand what rights they need to give their workers in each of the countries they're based in. We process the payroll, handle the tax filings. We also take care of the benefits. And right now, it's kind of a core benefits offering. It's mainly the things you'd expect, like pension, health insurance, and so on. But we're really broadening this from this year. We're going to be really focused on benefits. But I often joke that I'm going to set up a hybrid country. I often joke we need to establish a country because we have visibility over how each of these countries handles benefits and what the statutory rights are for employees in all of these countries. And some countries have some great initiatives and you just think if you could harness this and create a new nation that gives their employees the best of all nations, to coin a phrase, you could build a really fantastic society.
What about popping down to Malta or somewhere like that and asking them for a dig out? Would that work? Is the Isle of Man, I can never remember, is the Isle of Man in or out of the EU? I can never remember that.
I assume out.
I think there might be. Anyway, we won't go there.
We'll find an island somewhere to take over.
So I need you to tell me about the future of working, the future of a big issue. Solve me the shortage of workers in Ireland because they're going to come from abroad, but they're going to stay abroad. Isn't that right?
So I think the thing you have to remember is that people move around the world for all kinds of reasons. And people move back to home countries or choose to stay in home countries or choose to make new countries home for lots and lots of different reasons. And those reasons change at the different stages of an individual's life. And I specifically say in individual's life because what I might want at, you know, I am a child-free woman in my 40s. I'm single. I am planning on this year doing a few working holidays in a few different countries. I have that kind of flexibility. For me, that's important for my life. But I'm a dog owner. So that's a commitment that I have and something I need to take care of. Someone else my age might have
a dog minder for you.
I'll be taking you up on that. But people, there are lots of other people that are a similar demographic to me, but their needs or desires are very, very different. And what we have experienced over the last 2 years across lots and lots of sectors is that people's lives and their personal lives and their work have become intermeshed in a way we've never seen before. Now, we were heading in that direction. And in the tech space, we're a remote first company. So our team were all internationally remote long before COVID. We have 20 people now. Okay. We should be about 50 by the end of this year.
Wow.
So growing quite quickly. Good. And we will hire from any of the countries where we support employment. And if our people want to move between those countries, that's absolutely fine. And people do that. So really, we're heading towards a future where it is going to become far more common. And for companies that want the best workers, this is what they need to be supporting now. And we're seeing this in tech now. We're not seeing it in so many other sectors yet, but it will come. Companies are having to offer flexibility over when people work, where they do their work from, and how they work. And we're going to start to see a lot more flexibility around compensation.
And is this a benefit for the biggies, for the Googles, for the Facebooks, or are we talking about smaller companies?
I think we're actually seeing it more from the small to mid-sized companies. So the companies that have anything from a few hundred employees up to maybe a couple of thousand, they can be more nimble about their policies. So an example is we saw that Facebook fairly early on in the pandemic said that people could work from anywhere, they said initially, and then realized the complexity of that. And they have a list of its 8 countries, I think, that people can work from. So most of the very large countries will actually have very tight limitations around their flexible work policies, because they have processes that they are trying to comply with.
And I had a chat with Harry Goddard on the podcast. He's the CEO of Deloitte. And he was explaining to me that there is this complexity. So are you getting around that And if so, how so?
I don't know that we're getting around it. We are complying with all of these rules. So we're a compliance product.
But you also said that you are the employer. Is that correct?
We are, exactly. So at Boundless, we have entities. We have wholly owned subsidiaries in each of these countries. Our subsidiaries are registered as employers in those countries. So you will always have to be registered with the local tax authority to be an employer. We have local bank accounts. We have accountants and lawyers in those countries. We're set up to handle benefits, process payments and process payroll and so on in those countries. So that means then we can act as the legal employer. So the standard model, and it needs to be tweaked for some countries depending on the legislation, but the standard model is a co-employment arrangement, where it's a tripartite employment agreement.
I'm laughing to myself. I'm thinking, so many years ago, you could tell me what Beyonce ate for breakfast. Now you can probably tell me what you need to put on the menu in France, Germany, or wherever else you operate to get and find and keep employees.
I know all kinds of strange facts about taxation in various countries and employment laws.
Unless it's a trade secret, how many employees do you have now? Not your company, but how many indirect, if you like?
So
you up to thousands?
That's not something we share, but we will be up to thousands by the end of this year.
Fantastic. Yeah. And then funding, we know that Brian Caulfield is in there. Are you funding again?
Well, you're hearing it here first. We are literally just inking some documents for our existing investors to invest some more money. We had appetite from existing investors, and we had a really good opportunity on the sales and marketing side to do some work there that we knew would drive very quick, immediate growth. And we will be fundraising from Q2 this year. So around summertime, I'll be back talking to investors.
But are you talking to the VCs?
Yeah.
Like for our happy podcast listeners, can they get a cut of the action?
So we've raised 5 million to date, 5 million euro. We did pre-seed initially, then we did a seed round, and this is an extension to our seed round, the money that we're bringing in just this week. It will be a Series A that we'll be doing. So we have two venture capital investors already. Brian is an angel investor in our business, and we have a list of other amazing angels involved. We have two venture capital funds, Firefly Ventures, who are based out of Silicon Valley, and Ada Ventures, who are in London. This will be a venture capital round. So we're expecting it to be around 15 million.
That's all right.
So that's the round that we'll do later this year. So that'll be venture capital funds.
Does that freak you any that you have your 5 million in, but 15, that's getting serious now. That's 20 million you're into people for. Does that kind of make you lose sleep at night?
No. You know, I suppose I've been involved in the tech sector for a long time now. The businesses that I've been involved in have always been equity investment funded, generally always VC funds. I've done I've spoken to hundreds and hundreds of VCs over the last 13 years. So I suppose I knew when I was founding a business that it would be a venture capital backed enterprise. That's my comfort zone, I suppose. That's my norm. I'm always rather envious and fascinated by people that manage to bootstrap to scale. It's very rare and very unusual. And you will find that usually businesses that have bootstrapped for quite a long time, Teamwork are a really good example. You know, a business that got to about 50 million in annual revenues without venture funding, but they have since taken venture funding. So it's unusual for a business to get to scale without venture capital investment. In an ideal world, of course, you hold off as long as you can. Our business, we have to spend a lot of money with lawyers in a lot of different countries. That is unavoidable. We have an upfront cost for each country that we set up in. So it was always going to be venture-backed.
Two last questions. There'll be one obvious one, but the other one that I've just thought of is, what could Team GBS, they're our listeners, what could they do for you that would help you?
So two things that are closely related. First of all, if you are someone building a team or responsible for hiring and you haven't previously considered international remote, I would urge you to have a think about it. There's a crazy amount of material online about all of this, if it's something you want to research. We have great content on our blog at boundlesshq.com. If you go there and look at the blog, you'll find lots and lots of great content. We have a brilliant writer, Irina Jambajeva, on our team who takes care of all of that. If it's something you haven't done before, have a think. You can dip your toe in. We always say to people, you can start with one person in one country. Doesn't need to be a major commitment. The reason we say that is because once people try with one, they never go back. And the other thing then is, if you do have members on your team or contacts to people who have members on their team who maybe are being run as independent contractors, and people tend to know that's not legal in most countries, but we've all turned a blind eye at various stages because it's so challenging to solve these problems. But yeah, if you are hiring, wondering how to figure this out, or if you have contractors you would like to convert to compliant employees, we'd love to hear from you. That's if people can send us customers. That's the best gift anyone can give us.
And final question to Dee Coakley, co-founder of Boundless HQ. Who would she hire in a heartbeat?
It's a difficult question because there are so many amazing people out there. Someone that I heard interviewed some time ago, and the interview had a really big impact on me, was a woman called Sarah Fryer,
who is the CEO.
Yeah, she's the CEO of a business called Nextdoor. And she has built her career in Silicon Valley. I didn't actually know very much about her until I went to this talk. I was invited by one of our investors, I think, in London, and shortly before COVID. And she talked about her career, and it just resonated so much with me. And I ran straight back and talked to my co-founder about it. She talked about being an Irish schoolgirl and how it doesn't really serve you well in some ways in the world of business. And she was talking about particularly Silicon Valley. And she said she was very held back early in her career by trying to be a perfectionist and feeling that you must do things the right way. And she said that it was very liberating for her to learn how to do things more quickly and take bigger risks, and to not be so focused on always everything always being perfect. And it just really resonated with me, because even in this day and age, as a woman in tech, you still don't see very many women interviewed. And I was
Except
really impressed.
On That Great Business Show, we make a point of it.
Excellent.
And it's also lovely to hear that you have another woman co-founder as well.
I do.
And that is very, very rare.
It's incredibly rare to have a founding team with two women. My co-founder, Emily, she's a CTO. Female CTOs are like hen's teeth. But hopefully that's changing. But it's changing very slowly, very slowly.
You never know. There might be another COVID that might change everything again. Who knows? But anyway, first of all, it's fantastic to have you here. It took us a while to get you here. Dee Coakley, who is co-founder of Boundless HQ, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thinking of travel? If so, make sure to make Defacto, the world's best shaving oil, your choice of travel companion. A 25 milliliter bottle of Defacto means no hassle at airports, no bulky cans to carry, and the guarantee of the world's best shave. DefactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy to use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with five-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
You're listening to That Great Business Show. ThatGreatBusinessShow.com.
Just before I introduce my next guest, an entrepreneur of the year at just 12 years old, our pal Paula Fitzsimons asked me to remind you that applications are still open for her Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade-backed program called Back for Business. This program wants to see more of our emigres come home and set up businesses here, something we'd all welcome. Full details are on backtobusiness.com. And so too, Box of Wine. It's a business that delivers wines tailored to your specific taste direct to your door in a box. hence the name. The company turned over €500,000 in its first year. They've just taken on two new brilliant, that's how they're described, investors, and they're planning on entering the UK market this year. And as I mentioned, the founder was Entrepreneur of the Year at just 12 years old. Not unfortunately in the EY competition of the same name, but at his national school, I think, CBC Monkstown in Dublin. 29-year-old Conor Duggan, co-founder of Box of Wine, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thanks for having me, Conor.
You're Entrepreneur of the Year.
Yeah, age 12.
Was that in national or at secondary school?
It was, secondary. Oh, no, sorry, primary.
Primary school,
yes.
Yeah.
I was sixth class, so
that was
a long
very
time ago.
Enterprising of somebody to have that competition. I'd love to have done that. I think that's really cool.
It was our Ken King. He was our, he's now a principal in some secondary school, but he was great. Yeah, so we do that. We all had to set up a mini business and sell to the school and to the secondary school and stuff. So.
Well, you have, because I was looking at your CV, you seem to set up a business every second week or something.
Yeah.
And a lot of them
been
are
a few,
around.
A lot of mistakes on the way, yeah.
But that's where you learn, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. A lot of fun ones, a lot of learning, but yeah, it's made me grey.
Choose, well, at least you've got something to go grey, says the cue ball here. Did you choose the Box of Wine because of the wine business or because it's a recurring revenue business? Because I know that investors love a recurring revenue business, those blades and those other ones that deliver to your door, the food ones that deliver to your door every month or whatever.
Yeah, well, I just closed down a business during the pandemic, a recruitment business. I was recruiting chefs for the Dublin market. So I quickly knew that wasn't going to be coming back anytime soon. So I was just like, I need to do something. So I was kind of thinking through some ideas. And I love wine. It's my favorite drink. I wouldn't know a ridiculous bit out of it. I'm learning now myself. But my business partner now, Neil, he's our head of wine. He has 10 years experience. He's passed all these mad wine exams. He knows absolutely everything.
He's a smellier.
Yeah, so once I went to him, I was like, I think wine subscription is really underdeveloped in Ireland and the UK. So we saw kind of an opportunity there. So,
but now you say that it's underdeveloped in the UK, but I can even just talking to you, I can think of Sunday Times has a wine delivery service. Private Eye has one. Is it Odd Bins? I don't know whether Odd Bins even exist anymore, but I'm sure there are. Dozens.
There is a few now, to be fair. And we just think that there's no one doing it to the standard that it should be done. And we thought the tailored to your taste aspect, allowing people to take a quiz, is kind of interactive. It's fun. And
at least you're not calling it an algorithm.
Oh, yes. We haven't. There is a technical element to it, but we're actually building out the actual tech of our website. It's just one of these things. When we were getting it off the ground, we only had $5,000 budget to launch this business, so which is not a lot of money. So scaling a company to, you know, over $500,000 sales is
that's all right, yeah.
Difficult when you have such a small budget. But we, you know, myself, Neil, and my other business partner, Connor, managed to do it, so we're flying now.
So what is the model? How people find out about you, maybe through this podcast? I know that you're on News Talk with my very good friend Vincent Wall as well. So people find out about you, then what happens? I sign up and I say I really like big inky red wines.
Yeah, so you'll take the quiz. It takes 60 seconds on boxofwine.ie, and then we'll basically create a flavor profile for that specific customer. And then we'll send them wines that we think they'll like. And then they rate them every month. And then their wines get even better. And yeah, it's been great. Customers have been loving it. You know, we've a few hundred five-star reviews on Trustpilot. We're, a lot of happy people. So it seems to be going well.
But it's a ridiculous business, shipping bottles. Does it go by on post or by DHL or?
So we do all the logistics in Dublin with our own drivers, but outside of Dublin, yeah, we use DPD. But yeah, it's a bit of a nightmare because like every customer is getting a different box of wine. So we have like 200 wines at any given time. So like making sure the people, there's obviously a few mistakes along the way, but you know, it's difficult to to put it all together, but it means happier customers because they're getting, it's not the same wine just being shipped out to everyone because not everyone likes the same wine. So.
But then I can also, I don't want to be down in your business, but I can pop down the road and go into an O'Brien's or whatever and say, whatever. What's the difference?
Well, it's not going to be tailored to your taste. Like the person in the shop isn't going to know what you like. Just basically, you'll go in and you'll probably panic like the most of us do and go, oh, I like a Malbec. And you don't even know what that means. And then they'll just give you the same wine every time. And then there's no adventure to it. So like we obviously it is for very specific customers, but there's a lot of people out there that want to try something kind of exciting.
And that is, I presume it's the ideal gift as well for somebody who's likes his or her wine.
The gift, like gifts take up about 35% of our sales. So like there's definitely a big kind of section of that that we're exploring and trying to get better at. So.
And it's once a month drop.
Yeah, once a month, or you can do twice a week, or twice a week.
Yeah, so you're probably
twice
good.
A month. You can do as many as you like. So we're
but say
more than
once
happy.
A month, round figures. How much are people spending on three bottles? Is it three bottles of wine that
arrive?
Yeah,
so it's €55, including free delivery. But yeah, like
that.
These
the
wines
delivery,
are all
the free deliveries included in the 55.
Gotta include it. Yeah, so like the wines are all retailing for, you know, €16 to €22. So
oh, that's
like
right.
You're getting good value, great wines.
And how are you managing to undercut the ordinary retailer?
Well, we've just started to import ourselves.
Have you?
So that's one of the things that we're trying to do is focus on getting all of the wines in our range, wines that we're importing that are very unique. You know, we've just started importing some amazing Romanian wines and some great ones from Greece and stuff like that. So it's very exciting. Yeah.
Who came up with the idea of either Romania or Greece?
Well, it's my business partner, Neil. I leave everything to him. He's in very capable hands. He's worked with some big brands like Donnybrook Fair, FXBs and stuff. And he has a lot of experience under his belt for choosing great wines. And they, we've tasted them and they're absolutely amazing. So.
What? So that's the ad gone out there. So are you 26 counties or do you go north? Or
We're not in the north yet. We will, when we launch in the UK, we're going to start shipping up to Northern Ireland as well. It's just, you know, it's a bit of a logistical nightmare getting up there, so.
The M1. I know what you're talking about. I want to stick to the basic business, first of all, because you have to have, I presume, a very, very big catalogue of wines. You said 200 bottles or, 200...
Different wines.
Different wines. Your overheads for just for stock. Ouch. Mm.
Yeah, it's definitely an expensive business, but that's why we're trying to start importing ourselves, is to improve our margins slowly but surely. Hopefully by, you know, this time next year, we should have all of the wines as our own.
That's very good.
Which is, that's kind of the main aim. And that's kind of why we brought on some investors to help us do that. So.
Now, you didn't name them. So you call them brilliant.
Brilliant, yeah. Well, they are brilliant investors. They're great guys. They, Dave O'Donoghue and Dermot Murphy, they are two very experienced business people. They've worked in Arista, and Dave is the CEO and founder of Freshy, and they basically invest in a lot of food and drink startups. And we got chatting to them kind of along the journey, and they.
Now
like
you say you got chatting to them, because I'm always interested in these chats. Who introduced you, or how were you introduced, or were you standing watching a football match or a rugby match or something, and somebody said, oh, do you see who that is?
So we got introduced by a guy called Fergus, who's running another subscription business called Harvest Day. And I'd gotten chatting to him on LinkedIn. Great place to meet people. Just kind of see
now. Absolutely.
Yeah, amazing place to network. So we got chatting to him about his business, and we were helping each other promote each other's businesses because there's a bit of synergy there with he's delivering farm fresh food to your door, Harvest Day. That's a good plug. And we basically were chatting to each other, and he was like, I mentioned you to the guys who invested in my business and they'd like to have a chat with you. And I was like, we were already planning on going out, and I'd met a few investors that were interested, but we didn't meet anyone as passionate as these two. And that was the most important thing to us, was someone who was passionate about the brand that could get sink their teeth into it with us and teach us a bit as well, because they both come from a corporate background. Myself and the two guys don't have any corporate background, so we learned a lot from them so far, you know.
Let me go back a little bit, because amongst the many businesses that you were involved in was student marketing business. You had the rights to something called Slicker, a barber booking app.
Yeah.
Co-owner of Student Solutions, a marketing company that sold exclusive marketing rights to UCD Freshers. Nothing to do with delivery, nothing to do with wine.
Yeah, so it's definitely something new. Like, e-commerce is definitely something I was always interested in, and I'd read a lot of books about it and listened to a lot of podcasts. So, and like, to be honest, we're of the generation that you can pretty much set up any business with a phone. So I would never be afraid to just take on a challenge. I didn't know how big of a job, like, it's naivety is like one of your biggest, I don't know, friends, I guess, and enemies, because you just go in all guns blazing and then you realize 4 months in, when you're like moving into a new warehouse that has no heating and you're freezing your ass off packing boxes and you're working 67 hours a week, and then you're like, why was I doing this again? But like, naivety is a great thing.
When will you go to the UK?
It's going to be this year. Like,
have your new investors told you so?
They're the ones actually like making me do all the planning, and
that's what I was thinking. Yeah,
a lot of structure to it. So I'm the type of guy who just goes, we'll just do it, you know. So I'm basically doing a lot of planning now, making sure that the correct margins there. There's a lot to go into it before.
I presume there's a lot of things such as licensing. One is not allowed to sell booze. As sure as one is not, I don't think.
In the UK, licensing is very easy. Like, here, we've gone through a couple of licenses and it's cost us about 15 grand in you know, lawyers' fees, architect fees, the court fees, then the actual license is only 500 quid. But in England, you can get one for like 90 euro or 90 pounds. It's a lot easier. It's not as strict. So there's not a lot of red tape. So we're just kind of looking potentially at fulfillment partners or potentially setting up a warehouse ourselves in somewhere like Liverpool or something. So there's a few different ways we can go about it. But the plan is to be there before the end of this year.
But you're hardly going to import your Romanian / Greek wine here, ship it to the UK, distribute it. No.
Definitely not. The taxes in Ireland are absolutely insane.
Nuts, yeah.
You pay about $3.20 for every bottle in Ireland, and we're the highest taxed country in Europe for wine. So we're going to be importing into the UK and there'll be different wines in the UK, definitely.
Why is that, or what's that based on?
It's just based on the UK market's different. You know, everyone has a lot of different tastes in different regions. And
how do you know that?
That's actually something that our investors have taught us, because they've had a lot of experience in the UK market selling to every region of it.
And I was going to say, the regions are very, very pronounced as well. Yeah. London, inside the M25, completely different to when you go up north or whatever.
Absolutely. So we honestly don't know yet. The plan, we're very much just getting our, you know, ducks in a row. So we're planning everything now. It'll be interesting to see where we end up targeting with our ads the most. There's going to be a lot of testing once we do launch, but
presume they're online ads, yeah?
Yeah, we do pretty much exclusively digital marketing. I have a lot of digital marketing background, so that's kind of a heavy focus of ours. So
beyond that, or can you even think beyond that? Because big bad world out there, you could hardly go into mainland Europe, France.
It's definitely a possibility.
But come on, they're beyond served with it.
Yeah, like, I don't know. Like, I'd say there's some countries out there that might. I don't know enough about the market. I know a bit about the UK. I was born there, but
I can hear that from the accent. Not
6 months I lived there. It got me out of doing my Irish for the leaving cert, but nothing else. We know a bit about the UK market. So, but yeah, it would be a probably a big stretch to say that we're going to be anywhere else in the next 3 years.
How many are employed at the moment?
It's just three of us fully employed, and then we have a few kind of part-time drivers and stuff like that. So,
and where will you be within the year?
I
remember these famous plans that you're meant to draw up for your investors, the brilliant investors, we should always call them.
The brilliant investors, yeah. I would say about five employees or something.
Okay, is that you all very, very, very tight, yeah?
Yeah, like...
Can you make a living?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. We're all, you know, earning a living out of it, managing to afford to pay rent in this Dublin market. So, yeah, we're definitely making a living. It's just about taking it to the next level. We want to, you know, grow this to a few thousand.
You're beginning to sound like Brian O'Driscoll or one of those lads taking it to the next level.
Just say buzzwords, lots and lots of buzzwords.
I don't think anybody knows what that means. What is the next level?
Yeah.
You just want to sell more bottles.
Yeah, we want to like get up to like, you know, a few thousand subscribers. I think we can conservatively get up to around 3,000, 4,000 subscribers by the end of our year too, with the UK.
With the UK, okay.
The Irish market's tight now. It is.
But is that because we don't know about it, or? If it wasn't for Vincent now, I would not have heard of you.
Yeah, like we're trying our best to get the word out there, I guess. Like we've been in a lot of the major publications last year, the Irish Times, the Irish Independent, tons of stuff.
I can't read.
We teamed up at the Wineport Lodge Hotel to, you know, co-promote each other. We've kind of tested a lot of stuff. But
what worked best?
Definitely mainstream print media, which like I think I'm of the generation that was like, oh, digital media is like the best. But like honestly, some organic media like that, just being in the Irish Times and stuff, just it fills a lot of people with, I don't know, a bit of trust for the brand. So, yeah.
Okay. Who interviewed you in the Irish Times? Do you remember?
Oh, that's a difficult one. That's okay.
We'll move along smartly out of there. So, what can we call our listeners Team GBS? What can Team GBS do for you? Order wine at 55 euro a 3-pack?
I don't know. Just like even checking out our website and just having a read of our reviews and seeing if it's for you. Like, that's the kind of best thing I could always hope for.
And it's Box of Wine, because we previously, I had made up some other name for you.
Yeah, Box of
Wine. Don't say the other wine, but the other one, because
someone's going to go online and buy that domain, yeah.
Box of Wine.
Yeah, very simple.
Final question, it's what we ask all our guests, is who would you hire in a heartbeat?
So this is a difficult one. I did not... honestly,
the truth is he didn't read the email because I sent everybody the email and nobody's... I'm going to have to put it at the very top from now on.
I was focusing on the directions, making sure I got here on time. I would probably pick someone that's kind of, you know, like Amy Huberman, Brian O'Driscoll's wife, who's... And she's, you know, she's into her wine. She's cool. I think she'd be great to promote our brand, yeah.
She'd cost you too much.
Probably, yeah. I don't think we could afford her, but if she likes her rosé, then we could send her a box, you know.
55 quid.
That's all she's
bargain
getting.
Bargain of the century.
Exactly.
That is Connor Duggan, co-founder of Box of Wine. You better give your other co-founders, because there are two others, a shout out. Otherwise, they won't talk to you ever again.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, Connor Mulligan and Neil O'Reilly.
Neil is your sommelier.
The other Connor kind of makes sure the trains run on time. He's all about operations. So.
Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show. Connor Duggan, co-founder, boxofwine.ie.
Thanks for having me.
Not at all. And as always, these great business stories are brought to you by De Facto, the world's greatest all-natural shaving oil. Get it at defactoshave.com.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. De Facto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why De Facto leaves your face, underarms or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. De Facto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with five-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Canobio, at That Great Business Show.
On That Great Business Show, we say we do business differently. We do what others don't do. For that reason, we're starting a new occasional series about big law cases that are important for your business. There's a landmark 2019 High Court case between plaintiff John Clark and defendant CGI Food Services, which was about what you and I would call whistleblowers, or what lawyers love to call protected disclosures. The facts of this case involve, at one point, frozen pizzas that were defrosted and then frozen again, and that was followed by an avalanche of emails. Our man, in a wig, knows all of these details. Team GBS's learned friend, who also happens to host the excellent Law on Trial podcast, is barrister Peter Leonard, who tells me that every business owner and every employee needs to know about this case. Peter Leonard, BL, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thank you very much, Cuddle. Wonderful to be here. Wonderful to be here.
A very important case, but every case is important.
It's a very important case. What we're talking about here is protected disclosures, and as you said, whistleblower law.
I actually emailed you with the Squealer's Charter.
Well, you can call it what you want, but this is a particularly noble piece of legislation, and I'm going to champion this for you, hopefully in the course of this little segment. It all starts, if we can go back to the tribunals. Do you remember the tribunals?
I remember
and
them well.
Do you remember the great Colin McCaughey, currently a High Court judge, but now based in Europe, and he's a judge of the Court of Auditors in the European Union. And Michael Smith, I think it was, who's still very lofty in Ontashka. And they posted a notice with a solicitor's firm in Newry, Neary, Donnelly and Neary, and they offered €30,000 if somebody would provide information on planning scandals. Do you remember that?
I do.
And what did that produce?
One of the greatest tribunal characters
of the late 1990s, the legendary James Gogarty. And that led to the Flood Tribunal, and then we also had the Moriarty Tribunal into the mobile phone license and all that sort of stuff, and I won't go into it. But there was great entertainment for the world at large in those tribunals, and it was shown that there was a lot of kind of unsavoury carry-on going behind the scenes in, I suppose, public law and in public areas.
In little old Ireland.
So, effectively, this piece of legislation was brought in 2014, and it tried to kind of create a scenario where if somebody sees wrongdoing and they raise this issue, that they should be protected. Now, as you will know, in employment legislation, if something goes wrong, for example, if you're unfairly dismissed, which is a terrible thing to happen to anybody, but if that happens, the greatest redress you can get is 2 years' salary. But for this piece of legislation, because it was so noble and it wanted to protect disclosures of information and wrongdoing, you can get up to 5 years' compensation.
Okay.
If you're found to have been penalised for making a protected disclosure. So that's effectively it. Now, obviously, it has, you know, operated within state organisations, famously Maurice McCabe, all that sort of stuff. He highlighted certain issues within An Garda Síochána. And, you know, that led to various
different... AIB wasn't there.
Yes, absolutely.
And was it CRH was another one? Maybe the CRH one was not. Anyway.
Yes.
So.
Now, I know you're more interested in private business, but it is a feature that is coming increasingly into private business. And there has been a new European directive on protected disclosures in 2019, and that's trying to widen the scope and push it into private enterprise and private business relationships more and more. And the government, in response, has drafted an amendment bill, which is currently in the Oireachtas and is about to be enacted. It's going to happen some stage soon.
Someday this decade.
Yeah. What that does, though, is it requires any private business, any commercial entity that has 50 employees... they must now have a dedicated procedure for protected disclosures. and they must have a channel so that if I'm an employee and I'm working away and I see something wrong and I believe this should be brought to the attention and highlight some sort of wrongdoing that's taking place, there's a way of doing it. So, I mean, that's a little bit of pressure for companies to sort of set that up, and it's something they wouldn't have anticipated, and it's going to put a little bit of pressure on them.
And go back to the 5 years compo. Is that a little enticement for people to whistleblow?
Well, the word we use in the law is dissuasive. So it's to try and dissuade people from penalising anybody who has made, you know, who has made a disclosure. The notion is, even though the way the law is drafted, it isn't an altruistic disclosure as such. Once you disclose something that constitutes wrongdoing within the meaning of the Act, then you are a whistleblower. Now, you mightn't be doing it for the best of reasons, but if you disclose something...
So are you actually agreeing with me that people might be sitting there saying, do you know what, I could get 5 years compo out of this if I tell stories?
Well, you know, I mean, people, human beings being human beings, they will use that. And of course, that's what happens. I mean, in real terms, you know, people who are being employed in companies and it all goes horribly wrong and they want to look back and say, why did it go horribly wrong? And they want to get some sort of redress. They mightn't have redress. They mightn't have been in the company that long. For example, I am familiar with cases where people were headhunted, went in at a very high level. You know, it was supposed to be the dream job. Very quickly, personalities clash. It doesn't work out. The person's face doesn't fit. The person is there maybe only for a couple of months. They're still on a probation period. They don't have any claim under the Unfair Dismissal Act because they haven't been there 12 months. And then they're dismissed, you know? And they look back and they say, well, why did it all go wrong? Why did it horribly go wrong? Is it because I did something? Did I go in and point out something that, you know, that sort of ruffled feathers? Was that a good thing? Would that qualify as a protected disclosure? And if you can say it qualifies as a protected disclosure, you can potentially get redress. You can be reinstated or you can get substantial compensation. So yes, of course, it could be used cynically, but it is a very noble piece of legislation.
And so come back to this 2019 High Court case in front of Mr. Justice Humphreys, wasn't that
he? Yeah, so this is a really significant case. It is very rare that something like this would come before the High Court because it is set up to go before the Workplace Relations Commission. That's where you go down to Lansdowne House. Two sides go in, have the row about it, and a rights commissioner will make a decision, and then you can appeal that to the Labour Court. And if it gets very contentious, and potentially there's a point of law, it can be appealed to the High Court. But normally it doesn't go near the High Court. But under the protected disclosures legislation, there is the possibility, if you feel you're being forced out of your job because you made a protected disclosure, you can go to the Circuit Court and you can get an interim injunction. And that's what happened in this case. Mr. Clark was the financial controller. So he's a very senior bigwig within this company. And the relationship broke down. And, you know, once it had broken down, it led to him being dismissed from his position. So he went to the Circuit Court and he says, stop, I'm taking a claim before the WRC in relation to protected disclosures. I made protected disclosures and I'm being penalised for making those protected disclosures. And I want the Circuit Court to give me protection, ensure that I continue to get paid until that case has been determined. So the Circuit Court agreed to that. And then that decision of the Circuit Court was appealed to Mr. Justice Humphreys in the High Court. So Mr. Justice Humphreys is a very interesting judge, a very clever judge. I mean, they're all very clever. I would have to say that anyway, wouldn't I?
I was going to say that.
I couldn't possibly say anything other than that. But he is very good. And he took charge of this case and he grabbed it by the scruff of the neck. So in this case... effectively, it starts at the end. Mr. Clark has been dismissed. So he comes in and he says, you know, why was I dismissed? And he comes back and he says, because I made a protected disclosure. Now, the employer says, no, you didn't. You did raise certain financial irregularities, and we can come back to the detail of that. But that's what you're supposed to do. You're the financial controller. That's what you're supposed to do. So you're not going to get any medals for that. And you were doing your job. That was not a protected disclosure. And anyway, when you were making these kind of disclosures, you didn't say that they were protected disclosures. You know, you're only saying that now after the event. So I want to open a quotation here from the learned judge This case, if I can find it here, Cunnell.
You keep going there, great. And I'll keep chatting
away. This is the
away.
Closest we get to Shakespearean English in a high court decision, okay? And here is Mr. Justice Humphreys talking about the employment relationship. And I'm going to read it. Hopefully I can give the import of what the learned judge said. So he said, the breakdown of an employment relationship, like that of any relationship, is not necessarily a linear process with entirely logical and rational steps on all sides. There can be vacillation, mixed feelings, false dawns, reconciliations and setbacks. And sometimes it is only after the person picks themselves up off the ground, if even then, that they start to figure out what actually happened. Now, there you go.
You told me to be tearful. I'm tearful.
Well, I'm filling up at the thought of that. But the point being that he basically said it was now possible for somebody who has been dismissed to look back at what happened and what led to their dismissal. Now, in Mr. Clark's case, he looked back and he said, hold on a minute. As financial controller, he raised issues about credit card spending. There was a request from AIB in relation to director's expenses, and he raised issues in relation to that. When he looked further into what senior directors had been doing, he saw that money was being spent on paving footpaths and in, you know, driveways of houses. There was even a 13-week cookery course in Ballymaloe House. But you also have to show other wrongdoing. And he raised an issue of health safety. Remember, CGI Foods Limited, it's a food company. And one of the attention headline-grabbing issues in this case was that he alleged that a container load of pallets containing our 22 pallets containing pizzas, frozen pizzas, had been allowed to thaw, but then it had been refrozen again.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been sold on, apparently, and it was marketed towards young people. And he claimed, and I mean, as you know, when relationships break down, all sorts of stuff is said, ground hurling ensues. And he claimed that he said to the boss, to the employer, you know, this is outrageous that you're, you know, repackaging these pizzas that have, you know, thawed and that are geared towards children. And the boss said to him, you don't have to worry about it. You're not a child.
Okay. So that, anyway, that wasn't a good one-liner,
no,
was it?
No, it wasn't a good liner. Anyway, that was part of the detail. But I suppose the significant thing about the case is that the judge found the defence that was put up by the employer was, yes, this man is the financial controller. If he highlighted financial issues, that's his job. You know, there's no disclosure there. Yeah. That's not a protected disclosure. He shouldn't be protected for doing something like that. But the judge said no. If he highlights wrongdoing by the employer, by his superiors within the company, that is a protected disclosure and he is protected under the terms of the Act. And that has blown things open
and has meant that
cases now taken by employees in companies are taken a lot more seriously. It was very hard to get a protected disclosures claim over the line in a private company. Now it's a little easier.
And I don't know whether you know the answer to this, but what was the, was there a settlement in that case?
So effectively the High Court was trying to see whether the injunction should remain in place. It held that the injunction should remain in place until the WRC hearing was determined. My understanding was that it never got that far, that both sides sat down and sorted out their issues.
Which could have been done a long time ago. And there was also mention there of an avalanche of emails.
Yes, that was one of the other issues that basically, when Mr. Clark said that he started raising issues about financial concerns that he had, and again, it started in a very gentle way, as these things do, Cunnell, he suddenly found that the way he was being treated was different. He found that he wasn't being invited to management meetings, which he would expect to be invited to. And then he talked about the fact that suddenly he got an avalanche of a tsunami of emails. I think that was the phrase that he used. On one day, he got 1,754 emails into his inbox relating to his job. So he said that this was oppressive and this was set out to intimidate him and put pressure on him.
I'm just thinking, who or how can you organise 1,754 emails?
God only knows.
Okay. So what should an employer and an employee take out of all that you just said?
Okay. Well, look, relationships will break down in the workplace. That's what happens. You know, I mean, unfortunately, it's not a good thing. And I mean, I work in employment law, and I think next only to family law, it's the most emotion-laden type of law, because people give their lives to jobs, et cetera, et cetera, and then somebody gets a position they wanted, and it just creates discontent and emotion and all that sort of stuff.
Which, so relationships is, will break down. Which, to my point, means that people do and can use the law for retribution.
Yes, of course. Of course. And that's what they will do. And all is fair in love and war. That's what happens, Cunnell. You know, two sides come in. I mean, I can sit down with one side, I can sit down with the other side, and we can look at it in two different ways, and we can figure out a strategy about how we're going to address this. But I mean, the point is that if disclosures are made, if an employee identifies wrongdoing, that must be taken seriously. If there are issues in relation to an employee's performance, there must be a kind of a Chinese wall established by the employer in relation to any redress that the employer wishes to apply to this individual because they're not up to speed or they're not doing their job, or even a redundancy type scenario, that there is clear water between that and any issue that the person has raised. And if it is seen that an issue that a person has raised has been properly considered and gone through the processes, that would be, in my opinion, a full defence to any claim. But if there is, you know, if the water between the two is murky, if somebody is seen to have raised issues and then the world suddenly changes and the way they're viewed within the company changes, that potentially is a ground for a claim.
Oh, it's a great business you're in. Come here to me. Tell me this. If there is funny business on finances and it's pointed out by the whistleblower or by the protected disclosee, is that the correct term?
Yeah.
Whatever one is that... Does that go to the Garda, or does that go?
Well,
to
certainly, if it's a criminal matter, absolutely, it can go to the guards.
Yeah, you know? But who does that? Do I put up my hand and say, "Listen, I see some funny business here"? Does the individual, say the financial controller of a company, does he/she say, "Garda, come here, there's some funny business going on here"? Or do you go to the management and say, "Listen, this funny business going on"?
You go to the
here.
Management. You go to the okay. management and you say, look, I mean, you know, we know how companies are run. They're mm-hmm. supposed to be operated on the basis of the interests of the company. Yes, you have directors, you have employees and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, if somebody, like in this instance, highlights, let's say, an abuse of the credit card system or overpayments to certain individuals, that should be assessed by management, and management can make a decision on that. That probably wouldn't go into the criminal realm unless it is deemed to be a criminal offence. But within the company, it might be in the interests of the company if, for whatever, somebody's getting this beautiful garden with, you know,
I was
going to
say,
and,
yeah,
you know, the lawn is manicured and all that sort of stuff.
Our friends in the VAT and in revenue would be too.
They would be all ears, Cuddle. They would be all ears. So just don't tell them. Don't tell them. But no, absolutely. I mean, obviously, there's.
But if the final question or second final question is if the management doesn't do anything, do I then put up my hand and say, "Gordy, come here"? Or what does one do if you're trying to point out badness afoot in a company?
To go to, if you feel that there's some sort of criminal wrongdoing.
Yeah.
I mean, you can obviously contact the guards and make a complaint at any stage.
Okay.
And the guards are good. I mean, the fraud investigation capabilities of the guards are very solid at the moment. So they will look at that. But in the standard operating of a business, you know, the business has the capacity to put things right.
Okay.
You know, and to do the right thing in such circumstances.
Peter Leonard, who would you hire in a heartbeat?
Ooh, Cunnell, that's a question you've kind of landed on me a small bit.
Because
Brian is waving at the window, and I would rely on him 100%. I was, you know, Jurgen Klopp comes to mind. Jurgen Klopp, have you ever heard of him?
I have.
I was thinking
this
in terms of a legal person.
Legal person,
a man I have been very impressed by. Mm-hmm. I've just seen a few interviews with him. He's 80 years of age. He's a guy called David Boies, who's mm-hmm. a legendary lawyer, and he's a stand-up lawyer. They don't have barristers and solicitors in New York, as you know, they're all lawyers, but he's a stand-up lawyer. He addresses the court, and he is acting in the Prince Andrew case for Virginia Giuffre, if that's the correct pronunciation of her name. And I was blown away by the way he talked about stuff, but he was in a massive case for Microsoft. And as somebody who has to read kind of weighty tomes at times and likes to speed read and hope I've read everything and try and pretend I've read everything at all stages, he talked about how for a case that ran for 6 months, he read every single document and was across everything. Not that he needed to refer to it, but just in case he needed to refer to it. How about that?
I did see him on Newsnight, and he does, you know, he is very open. He
comes very, open. TV, he's as fit as a fiddle. Have you, like 80 years of age.
I didn't know he was 80. Yeah, so yeah, I actually thought, sharp as attack, yeah. Much younger than that, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, very he's impressive. Hired, I think. Okay, I'd say on. I wouldn't like to see his fee notes, though.
No. I wouldn't like to have to pay his fee notes.
Well, more to the point. Lots of zeros at the end of that.
Yeah, but maybe you're getting a good service. You know?
Peter Leonard, BL, will you come back?
Connell, I would be delighted to.
Well, you are now Team GBS. And your podcast is called...
Law on Trial. We do it in association with the Sunday Business Post, or the Business Post newspaper, no longer Sunday Business Post. And we're coming back out in February. So me and another colleague from the Law Library and the legal correspondent of the Business Post, we bang on about law for an hour. And it's
very nice. It's very
it's,
good.
It's,
I've listened.
It's done okay. Yeah. We're getting a decent response.
I didn't
response.
Speed listen. I actually listened. So
well, very good. Well, thank you, Connell. That's great. Great to hear.
Peter Leonard, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show. And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 71. Don't forget, today's theme is sharing is caring. Please, please share this podcast with your connections on your social media. You look smart and we look happy. In other words, don't be saying well done or we like or anything. It's a simple share. My thanks to all the team here at the Dublin Podcast Studios, including today's sound engineer, Brian Begley. And then Peter Rice, who every week makes sure we are the world's best sounding podcast. Do please share this podcast with anyone who loves business, home or abroad. And also do subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform. That makes sure that Ireland's best business podcast is always in your pocket. And we are here to help businesses just like yours. So if there are issues or topics you would like us to cover, contact us using LinkedIn, where we have our dedicated LinkedIn page. And you can also maybe post some questions to my learned friend, Mr. Peter Leonard, BL, and you get a free consultation from him on this podcast. And if you're planning an ad campaign, we'd love to help. Join companies like Big Red Cloud and Virgin Media, as well as organizations like ISME and Udaras na Gaeltachta, who recognize it's a great way to talk to Ireland's SMEs. And as always, the great business insights you hear on That Great Business Show are only made possible thanks to our sponsor, the great makers of the world's best shaving oil, De Facto, made in Mayo, sold worldwide. Our thanks to them. So from me, Conall O'Moran, Gurv Mila Mahagav, Agus Slán Tamal.